Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. This is episode 104. So, we heard you like money. Who told you that? We don't like money in this house.
I have thoughts.
We have thoughts.
As about the person money. Who wrote this episode title, I have thoughts. So we're back. It has been a couple of weeks. Life has been utterly banana pants.
I think that's a very generous way of putting it. I feel like you and I have barely had the opportunity to breathe. Yeah. Or be people.
So just to give you a peek into our lives away from the hallowed halls of virtual economy.
No one would ever call virtual economy hallowed.
That's because of the mouth fart analysis. So, that. So, on the personal side of things, Amanda and I are both on the executive committee of the Booster Club for the marching band. And we had our big event. We hope it's a competitive marching band. For those of you not in the United States, hit us up. We'll explain this weird thing. For those of you in the United States, especially those of you on the East Coast, you might be familiar with this. We had 12 bands coming to our high school. It is an extremely intense month getting
it's
ready
a
for that.
Monumental
because,
effort.
Because we can't really get started before school starts because we don't have parents' attention. And we need like every single parent that's available playing a role. On top of we need the administration's attention and the band directors. And let me tell you something about band directors. They are not detail-oriented people when they're off the field.
Yeah.
Not at all. Like,
yeah.
Not at all. And then on the professional side, we wrapped up our most intense project ever. It was a project we were in conversations with this client for a number of months, and it finally kind of came to fruition with a very tight turnaround. And it was way more intensive than anybody quite realized it was, including the client. So we did that, and we wrote a ton. And
many,
it was a lot.
Many thousands of words were written.
Yes. So that is now behind us. Our schedule is finally starting to breathe like a fine wine.
I prefer scotch, but yeah, okay. We can do wine.
Okay.
We'll decant some wine on this episode. So it'll be our version of the tea.
Yes. So this episode, because we are going to be back on Saturday for a normal episode, we wanted, and there's a number of bigger stories that we're going to talk about on Saturday that have happened over the past couple of weeks. So we wanted to knock out investment interlude and quick hits.
There's so much.
There's been a lot of investment. The funny thing is the last two shows we've had relatively
three or four
investment stories. Oh yeah, it's 2021 though. And here we are.
And here's the deluge.
Yeah, so what's kicking us off, Amanda?
All right, kicking off investment interlude today, Nacon has announced the purchase of Ishtar Games and the creation of a new label for independent games. Ishtar developed Dead in Bermuda, Dead in Vinland, and the recently released The Last Spell.
I actually played The Last Spell during the Steam Next Fest. I streamed it. And it's
the last Stream Next Fest or this current?
Not the current one, the last one.
Oh, okay.
So you might recall this game. We saw it during some of the digital presentations. You're in this town and you have these units, and then every night the creatures come and.
Oh, right. I remember that game.
Yeah,
now.
It's really intense.
It's neat.
It is. It's really intense. So this is a cool pickup for Nacon, especially since they're going to lean a little bit harder into having a place within their company for independent games.
Absolutely. So the nice thing about this is that Ishtar will retain its editorial independence. And this is the 14th Nacon studio.
I remember Nacon used to be Big Ben.
Yes, I do remember that. No terms were disclosed.
Yeah. Voodoo has acquired casual mobile developer Beach Bum. No terms were disclosed, but TechCrunch sources say the deal is valued at, quote, a few hundred million dollars.
Yeah, just a small deal.
Yeah.
Tiny.
Beach Bum's revenue over the last 12 months was $70 million on its three App Store games, Backgammon, Spades Royale, and Gin Rummy Stars. $70 million on in-app purchases for three games that are, let's be honest, relatively unremarkable and based on public domain card games.
And at the same time, that does speak to the power of the mobile marketplace. This is why we talk mobile, people.
Like, this is not the first mobile story we've covered where it's like, these games are ridiculous. Like, these are not innovative games, but somehow they're capturing...
But they're accessible, especially to older audiences. And as we... If you all will go back in time with me for a moment to the realms of the Wii and how
that's a really good point.
And how that created a level of inclusiveness and accessibility for older players, for players that never considered themselves to be gamers before. This is a great way for older players that might not feel comfortable playing something more intensive, like in Apple Arcade. Mm-hmm. You know, where they feel like, oh, I know these games. I can play these games. These games are for me.
Yeah.
And there's, you know what, that there's a comfort in that.
And then they'll turn around and make $70 million worth of in-app purchases.
Sure. Yeah. Like one person did that. Mega
one
whale.
One person.
Mega whale.
Yeah. Jeff Bezos.
It's Jeff Bezos.
He loves his backgammon.
He really does.
So here's the interesting thing. So Voodoo might be a name that our listeners remember. I know you do.
Oh.
And I certainly do.
I do remember Voodoo.
So I reported on them when Donut County developer Ben Esposito called them out for cloning his game.
Donut County.
Right, yeah. And with Hole.io was Voodoo's game.
You know what's hilarious and messed up?
Our kids.
Our children started playing Hole.io until I'm like, what are you doing? Play Donut County.
Yeah.
Here's Donut County.
Have a garbage day.
Have a garbage day, children.
Yeah, so Voodoo is also responsible for Helix Jump and Crowd City and others. So when I reported on this for Variety, the Voodoo website touted that the company purchased, quote, cheap installs, which is a violation of the App Store.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
So what happened was they backpedaled and they're like, well, we don't actually pay people to install our game. We just buy, what did they say, targeted ads.
Well, and as we have discussed in relatively extensive ways about in-app bidding and hybrid mobile ads, especially these days, you know, throughout 2020 and 2021, how the ad market on mobile has changed significantly. Mm-hmm. It is interesting, but also that's a capital Y for yikes.
Yeah, so it was a really interesting story. And of course, their major funder, Voodoo, their major investor was Goldman Sachs. So Goldman Sachs freaked out when Variety published my story.
That was hilarious.
Yeah.
I had a good chuckle.
That was an interesting story, but that's not a for here story.
But you know what is a for here story?
What?
Let's talk about what Netflix is doing. As we have previously reported, Netflix is, I don't know, doing stuff with games?
Yeah, this is not Netflix's first foray into games. Obviously, the Minecraft Story Mode, the only place that you can play it right now, unless you had a physical copy of it, which I bought for the Switch because they were all on the carts.
Yes.
And that game is delisted everywhere.
Yep.
You can play it on Netflix still.
Yep.
So that
very interesting.
Yeah.
I think the kids have actually played it on Netflix now that I think about it.
Interesting. And then, of course, they've got things like Black Mirror Bandersnatch, which is a choose-your-own-adventure style experience.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Netflix has acqui-hired Night School Studios.
This was super interesting. It's a very good fit.
This one kind of hit me out of left field, but it's super cool because these are the folks behind the most excellent and critically acclaimed Oxenfree, as well as After Party, which I have yet to play, but I have been deeply interested in for a long time.
Yeah, it's sitting in my Epic Game Store library, and I have a funny feeling like when my Gabe gear gets here.
When your Gabe gear gets here? I cannot with that, but okie dokies. So anyway, according to Netflix's press release, quote, these games will all be included in your Netflix membership. There are no ads, no in-app purchases. And yeah, so that's interesting. But here's what I liked. And I went and I read up on what Night School had to say about this. And this is from Sean Krankel.
Who's a great guy. We met him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Quote, our explorations in narrative gameplay and Netflix's track record of supporting diverse storytellers was such a natural pairing. It felt like both teams came to this conclusion instinctively. So that's cool. The other thing that is cool is they're still making Oxenfree 2.
That's great.
And it's not tied to Netflix.
So here's the interesting thing. You may recall, again, I wrote about this for Variety. When Telltale died, It had been working on a Stranger Things game.
Yeah.
For Netflix. What hadn't been reported at the time was that Night School was working with Telltale. They weren't working directly with Netflix. They were working with Telltale.
Okay.
So it's really interesting to see that come full circle, because I have a funny feeling what we're going to end up seeing here is Stranger Things is a ripe property for games.
Oh, certainly.
There's already been two games. I played the mobile one.
I remember.
We were on vacation. I think I played that.
Yeah.
And then there was Stranger Things 3, which wasn't quite as well received.
Right. So this is that natural evolution, I think, for Netflix and hiring such a talented team. I'm looking forward to seeing what they create together. If anyone can make it go, it's definitely Night School.
Absolutely. Next up, two Sony-related acquisitions have hit the radar. Remember when, I think it was Sony Japan, accidentally revealed that Sony was acquiring Bluepoint Games?
The chuckle. I had such a chuckle at that.
So this is going to come as a huge surprise. Sony has actually acquired Bluepoint Games.
Oh, man.
So for those of you who aren't like making the mental connection, Bluepoint is behind the excellent remake of Demon's Souls that came out at the launch of the PlayStation 5.
Yep.
They're also behind that amazing remake of Shadow of the Colossus on the PlayStation 4 and a number of other things. Now, here's the interesting thing. They're not working on a remake as their next project.
What are they doing?
They're doing something original. Ooh. Now, I did see one little thing that floated, and I wonder if this might be true, and I kind of hope it is. Now, Bluepoint has done the remake of Demon's Souls now.
Sure.
And they understand what made that game go. Sure. Whether you like it or not, they understood what made that game go.
No, it's totally fine. Listen, everybody has different kinds of games that they love. Those kinds of games just happen to be not games that I love.
There, I saw something float, like, what if they're working on Bloodborne 2?
I mean, maybe?
I would play that. Souls games and I have not finished Demon's Souls. I have not finished any of the Dark Souls games.
How much you love Bloodborne,
Bloodborne though. Was so good.
I tried playing that with you. I think when we were long distance, we played that together briefly. And I'm like, I can't with this game. It's just, it's too intense. I need to, let's go play Until Dawn instead.
Yeah,
apparently.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah.
So unsurprisingly, no terms were announced. The other piece of news that popped up, you might recall we talked about this on the show. Fire Sprite, which was acquired by Sony in September.
Yeah.
Apparently at the same time, they made an acquisition of their own. So Fire Sprite was made up of a number of the Sony Liverpool team members that worked on the Wipeout series. Now, Sony Liverpool was formerly Psygnosis.
Mm.
Yeah. And that studio was shuttered, I can't believe it was this long ago, in 2012. And people at the time were like, come on, Wipeout is amazing.
Yeah.
It's a great racing series. So as part of that deal, Firesprite acquired Fabrique Games, which is the studio behind The Persistence, which was a VR-first game that was then translated into a flat-screen experience on PC and console. Of course, no terms were disclosed on that one either. It is really interesting. You and I have talked often about this cyclical thing that happens in the game industry, right? You've got consolidation, and then you've got closures.
Yeah, and then there's more branching out as people go off to start their own studios. And then, you know, sometimes first parties like, oh, we used to hang out with you. Well, we could do that again.
Well, and there's some really interesting, and I know we don't often talk about rumors on this show, but I think there's just some leaked information. Obsidian, the acquisition of Obsidian by Microsoft was a really big deal.
It was.
Apparently Avowed, remember that game that looked like...
I do.
That looked Skyrim-y, like Elder Scrolls-y?
Yes.
Apparently that's set in the Pillars of Eternity universe.
Interesting.
So, that game already like had its hooks in me when we first saw
gimme.
It, so I'm interested.
Extremely gimme.
Yeah. Moving on up.
All right, let's talk about some streaming stuff. Stream Elements has acquired gamer-centric YouTube multi-channel network. I always forget what an MCN is, so I had to go look it up. And digital media company Paragon.
Okay, so let's stop here. Let's talk about what MCNs are.
Okay, so multi-channel networks, from my understanding of them, is a collection of individual channels that are considered partners within a greater distribution network.
So the one that people probably know of was Machinima. Machinima was an MCN.
Yes. Machinima, I believe, might have been one of the originals.
Yeah. And part of the reasons why you had an MCN back then was, hey, sign with us. And then they leveraged that to make deals
of course.
company. So before, this is in the early days of YouTube.
Sure.
Before you had streamers, before you had big streamers who were who had talent representation.
Right, because there are talent management companies out there now that that do work with a wide array of great talent, including the Noir Network.
Yes.
And I think Nani Talent is another really great one.
So, you know, before you had agents and agents and management that were working on behalf of content creators, MCNs were a way to go to a brand and say, hey, we have these 50 channels. If you sign a deal with us, we can then manage the deals with you. Now, there was some real shady shit that happened along the way.
Sure, because everything was the wild digital west.
Right. And this was before the FTC got really persnickety about disclosing when there were sponsored deals.
Yes, absolutely.
And oftentimes, the big one that I remember covering back when I was a Game Informer was, I think it was Machinima, in their deal was, do not disclose that this is a sponsored deal.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, can't do that anymore.
No.
That's not a good idea.
And back then, I mean, we're talking about 2013, 2014, 2015, the idea here was like, hey, people like me who were in media, who didn't know a whole lot about content creation back then, was, no, you got to disclose this stuff. And thankfully, I would say that the structures have caught up with that, that people have gotten so much better. There used to be a time where you would not see hashtag ad or hashtag sponsored anywhere.
And part of that is the FTC's enforcement. And the other part of that is the change in culture.
Yep.
Because when we understand the underpinnings of how content creation works as a business, and quite frankly, it is important that we do stipulate content creation is a job, and it is not always a well-paid job, especially
based on what we know from the Twitch League, which we'll talk about on Saturday.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that on Saturday. Yeah, not a well-paying job, but it is still, in fact, a job. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people are taking that more seriously. They're taking they're taking laws more seriously, and their audiences, because audiences are being trained to support sponsored content, to support ads, to support, you know, partnership streams, everything like that. It's helpful because streamers are training their audiences to just be like, this is just part of my content. I was paid for this and it's still me.
Yes.
So anyway, let's talk about the actual acquisition here because this acquisition is really interesting. So we reported on the significant investment in Stream Elements. I believe it was in September at some point when this happened. And this is another way for Stream Elements to sort of move in a lateral direction to create like this holistic service, right? Not just relying on their monetization of their tools or anything like that, because from what I understand, you know, they're still going to be offering their tools and everything like that for the foreseeable future. But this is great because money moves like this are to shore up those those external services. So Stream Elements will be changing Paragon's partnership program, and they're changing it for the better.
Okay.
They will no longer be taking commissions off of user-generated content, transaction, or standard ad revenue.
Well, that's really interesting.
It is really interesting.
So it looks like they'll be taking commissions off of sponsorship deals, right?
That is what that is my understanding here. Paragon's members will also have access to scaled sponsorship opportunities thanks to Stream Elements. So this is pretty big. An acquisition of an MCN and digital media company is not small. That is an enormous undertaking. And Paragon, from what I understand, is fairly large. So No terms were disclosed as far as I understand, but that's that whole situation.
Very, very interesting. All right, what's up next? Niantic.
Yes.
Niantic has acquired Haas.
Yes.
Which, after the hate raids with all those Haas bots, like,
I know, I had a moment while I was covering this. I'm like, oh, not a Haas bot. No Haas bot. Oh boy. Okay, no Haas bot.
Yeah. So this acquisition will help to accelerate and expand the development of the Lightship developer experience and portal. Lightship is Niantic's augmented reality development kit to help speed up AR development projects, Niantic being at the forefront of AR game development, especially.
Absolutely.
And Haas is known in the industry for refining developer experiences around API-driven development and environment. So this is a perfect fit.
It is absolutely a perfect fit. No terms were disclosed for this one either, but this is a match made in AR heaven.
Great.
All right. That's rad. It is. It's super cool. This one was, wow, I had took a second for this one. AppLovin has announced that it has entered into a, quote, definitive agreement with Twitter to acquire MoPub for approximately, wait for it, 1 billion bells for Tom Nook.
So I have a question. Is AppLovin its real name, or is that just what it has on its fake ID?
This is not McLovin. This is AppLovin.
Oh, my mistake.
God, that was a really messed up reference, but okay.
You're welcome.
Yeah, mm-hmm. This is, mm-hmm. That's why we're family. For those that might not be familiar, AppLovin is a platform that mobile publishers and advertisers use to connect mobile apps with targeted advertising for their users. Now, this valuation is banana pants.
Yeah.
It's, I sat there reading this and I'm like, wait, what? That's, no, you're not Dr. Evil either.
$1 billion.
$1 billion. MoPub is actually used by 45,000 mobile apps currently to manage monetization. Yeah. Reaches 1.5 billion addressable users worldwide.
Now, I think the one thing that we haven't mentioned yet is who did you say that who they purchased it from?
Yeah, Twitter.
Yeah, it's wild, right?
Yeah, they purchased it from Twitter because Twitter's not doing anything with mobile app monetization.
Sure. And at the same time, that revenue stream.
It would have been a fantastic revenue stream for them to hold on to, but I don't think they were doing anything with it. I mean, MoPub has been around for quite some time, so.
Bananas.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is coming directly from MoPub. Quote, ultimately, this combination aims to continue the acceleration of the shift to in-app bidding that we have witnessed on our in-app bidding solution. By doing so, we can continue to increase the transparency of pricing and improve efficiency by expanding access for both buyers and sellers. Mm. So again, moving towards this hybridization of in-app bidding and mobile advertisements, it's really, really interesting. What this means is it means that AppLovin is going to become an even bigger player than they already are in mobile advertising, and this will definitely stretch out to gaming.
Really, 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 really interesting.
Absolutely.
All right. This one I saw, gosh, was it last week? I don't know. Time's a flat circle, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Kowloon Knights.
Okay, yes. We're very familiar with Kowloon Knights.
Yes. Founders of Kowloon Knights have announced the creation of Kepler Interactive, which it describes as a, quote, super developer group. Yeah, let's put your, yeah, it's like, you just need a cape.
I think that my shirt counts as a cape
your
today.
Your shirt counts as a cape.
It does. It's a very large shirt.
If you're not familiar with Kowloon Knights, it's a video game fund that is partnered with studios like Pictogram and Rose City on Garden Story, Thunder Lotus on Spiritfarer, Slow Clap on the upcoming Sifu, and many other games that we're excited for, like Welcome to Elk, We Are OFK, Sea of Stars, Commonhood.
We Are OFK. I need Commonhood. Need.
So, if you're not familiar with them, though, that's by design, because Kowloon tends to step out of the way. They're not a publisher. They don't want to be in the way. They want developers to shine. So even though they're involved in all these projects, you're not likely to see them stand in front of the developer and be like, hey, this is ours.
Sure.
So Kepler, which is backed by $120 million in funding for its first consists of seven different developers.
Okay.
A44, which made Ashen and is working on an unannounced game.
Yep.
Alpha Channel, which is working on the upcoming Tankhead.
Okay.
Awaseb, which is working on, and I know you love this.
Chia? Chia, it looks so good.
Yeah, that's going to be released. Ebb Software, which is working on Scorn, yet to be released. Shape Farm, which released the most recent Samurai Jack game.
Mm-hmm.
And Vayne.
Yep, familiar with
both. Slow Clap, which was Absolver and the upcoming Sifu. And then Timberline, which is the Red Lantern.
Which
is a survival game.
Yeah, right? so cool.
So this is, Kepler is not your traditional, and this is unsurprising coming from Kowloon, right? So Kepler, it's co-owned and run by the development studios, and the model is designed around creating co-owners in the supergroup out of those participating studio founders.
That's super cool.
So they are, like, going to be a council, essentially.
A council of super developers.
Yes. And those studios that are involved, those first seven studios, are going to be making key decisions about the future of Kepler, including when and who to bring in when they expand.
Oh, neat.
So that's super cool. So Kepler's going to be providing essentially operational, financial, and publishing support to those member studios. Think of this like, I want to say like shared services, right? Sure. Or a co-working space with services on top of it.
What this reminds me of is a refinement of Gathering of Developers.
Yeah. All right. Right? Yeah, right? Absolutely.
If we take, again, let's get into the time machine and go all the way back to the early aughts, which you may not be familiar with, but Gathering of Developers is, yes, we are old. Gathering of Developers was the sort of the breeding ground, I suppose, the petri dish from which Devolver Digital and Good Shepherd ended up evolving out of. Yeah. So it was, you know, Gathering of Developers was a really, really important first step, especially into indie publishing. Yeah. So this, to me, is a refinement of that idea.
It's really neat. I'm very excited by it. And what's interesting, again, like, these are studios that have come together to create this, with Kowloon Knights founders kind of guiding this process.
I love it.
They have headquarters in London and Singapore. They have 250 employees in 10 countries because Holy of crap. All of those studios coming together. It's wild.
Amazing.
So very excited to see what comes out of that.
Me too. That is cool as heck. All right. Super Social has raised $5.2 million to make games for Roblox.
Roblox.
Super Social has 24 full-time employees based out of Columbus, Ohio. It is building itself out to be the, quote, Nintendo of the metaverse age. Not really sure how to interpret that.
Those are certainly words put together in a string.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is brought our way via GamesBeat and from the interview with the studio's founder. So I thought that was really interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it means, but I'm interested to find out. They brought on industry leaders from Nintendo, in fact, Chris Campbell, Big Fish Games, Peter Yap, and DreamWorks, Kara Khan. So those are principal designer, technical director, and art director. Gotcha. Initial capital led the investment with contributions from some familiar faces, including Griffin Gaming Partners, Warner Music Group, Mark Benioff's Time Ventures, Lightshed Ventures, Powerhouse Capital, Arim & Co., and some angel investors. Good old metaverse.
All right, what's next?
This one was weird. So
love it when a store when an invest. So this investment is very strange.
It's not strange in the sense that investments were made. It's strange in the sense that I have no idea. I still don't have much of an idea of what Aristocrat Digital is.
Hmm.
So they're making their own money moves in acquiring three mobile game studios. So Aristocrat Digital has approximately 2,300 employees globally in over 14 locations. It's comprised of three major operating businesses in Polarium Global, which is in Israel, Product Madness in the UK, and Big Fish Games in the US.
Well, Polarium we've covered before. They're in the mobile space, obviously. And Big Fish, of course, is in the mobile space.
Of course.
So I'm going to go with... They make mobile games,
but they're like part of an athleisure global brand.
Look, if you're going to sit around and play mobile games, be comfortable.
Be comfy, I guess. You know what? Go on with your bad self. I didn't really understand what Aristocrat, the global company, did, but yeah, I sort of got
also,
what
Aristocrat being a name for an athleisure company just...
I mean, that's what I understood. Maybe they're just a leisure company. I don't know what a leisure company is. It was like... Aristocrat Leisure. And I'm like, so are you athleisure? So I just made the assumption that they're an athleisure company in my headcanon, and that's where we're leaving it.
They just, they want to help you spend your free time.
Yeah. You know what? It's headcanon.
While comfortable.
Now. No, it's headcanon now. And listen, if you actually figure out what Aristocrat Leisure does, because listen, we had very limited time to do these show notes. Anyway, Aristocrat Athleisure. No, I regret nothing!
I'm sorry, did you say they make leisure suits?
No, but only for people not named Larry.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah, it's not okay. Anyway, so Aristocrat is acquiring Helsinki-based free-to-play mobile studio Future Play, which specializes in the Merge Match 3 segment of the casual market. Now, remember when I talked about Merge games when we were talking about Zynga?
Yeah, absolutely. I asked you, like, what the hell is a Merge game?
Yeah,
and you had an answer, and I loved it.
I did have it. I always have answers with mobile stuff. So Future Play is actually the studio behind Merge Gardens.
Okay.
Which is, to me, what made this investment all that more significant, because Merge Gardens is such a popular game. They are also acquiring Helsinki-based studio Northern Stars, which will develop, quote, hybrid casual games. I had to go look up what a hybrid casual game is, and I went to our good friends at AppLovin.
Ah, well, there you go. Everybody's loving AppLovin.
Everybody's loving AppLovin. So according to AppLovin, quote, hybrid casual is a relatively new style of mobile game that incorporates the simplicity of hyper-casual gameplay with more sophisticated progression mechanics that appeal to mid-core audiences.
Interesting.
So, I don't know, no real information was given about Northern Stars. I looked them up, and I'm like, who are you? I couldn't find anything. So, they exist in a press release, as far as I'm concerned. And creating hybrid casual games, which now I know what they are. And finally, Aristocrat is acquiring Playsoft, which is based out of Poland and has a 13-year track record of mobile game development specifically for third-party partners.
Very interesting.
Yeah, but it was still weird.
Yeah.
It was still weird.
Because they make leisure suits.
Because they make leisure suits for Not Larry's.
Yes.
Actually, I really do want to see if I can figure out what this is, because now I'm really curious.
All right, 1939 Games, which is the Icelandic studio behind the World War II-inspired Cards with a K mobile game, has raised $5.3 million for a mobile version of the game. The investment was led by Korea Investment Partners, Woori Technology Invest, Seoul Investment Partners, Sisu Games V-Centures. That's an interesting one. And Crowberry Capital.
Oh my God. No, wait. Before we continue, breaking news. Aristocrat Leisure.
Do they make boats?
No.
Boats.
They make gambling machines.
Oh, that
kind of Oh my God. Oh my God. I should have just looked it up yesterday, but I just...
I don't know. If you've been to Atlantic City, you might know that there is an alignment between athleisure...
So they're an Australian gambling machine manufacturer. And
but of course...
In 2019, they made $698.8 million for their net income. So...
Bananas.
So, like... you know what? I like my explanation better. We're just going to say they make athleisure. Nailed it. Got him. anyway, sorry.
So back to cards. The mobile version is slated for launch in 2022 with cross-platform play with the current PC version.
Awesome. All right, let's talk about Game Jolt.
Game Jolt. Love them.
Game Jolt, which is a social media platform that hosts interest groups based around games like Pokemon, Sonic, and Undertale, as well as those focused on dev tools like Blender and Unity. And game audio and pixel art forums. Listen, Game Jolt has a lot of stuff going on.
Yup.
And they've raised $2.6 million in investment.
That's huge for them.
That's really big for them. So the company, which is based in Seattle and run by the husband and wife team of David and Yaprak DeCarmine? Mm-hmm. Whatever. Either of those are fine. Are going to use the funds to expand Game Jolt's platform and reach. Funding was led by, Asiquia? Yeah, we're going to say that. Capital, with Medora Venture Group, Graph Ventures, and InVentures Collective participating. The round also included Twitch co-founder Kevin Lin, Rec Room co-founder Nick Fate, and the founders of Mod.io.
Oh, there you go. Excellent.
Next.
All right. MyDot Games has announced $3 million in new investment in three new developers based in the Commonwealth of Independent States, the former USSR.
Mm-hmm.
First up, Two Rogue Games, based in Moscow, is working on a mid-core mobile free-to-play game due for release in 2022. Wideview Games, based in Minsk, is working on two mobile casual free-to-play games due in 2021. Wideview's Tamadog project was selected by Apple for its Tech and Innovation Game of the Year. So that's an interesting investment. And Vox Studio, based in Moscow, is working on... And this one caught me off guard. It's like Game Studio. Working on a voice-based dating app.
I'll allow it.
Yeah.
I'll allow it.
Hey, baby. How you doing? I just come up and whisper real close. It's like, I know you like my voice.
Do
you
want crinkle.
Crinkle. You want to date me? That's right.
Gross. It's gross and bad, and I don't like it. There are often times where I look at my life, and I'm like, man, so glad I don't have to date people.
MyDot Games Venture Capital is one of the 15 largest investment funds in the world, according to InvestGame. It has a 40-studio portfolio and has completed 47 deals since its inception in 2017, 10 of which were in 2021.
That's impressive. All right, Homa Games has raised $50 million in Series A funding. The round was led by North Zone with Singular King, the founders of Fubo TV, and Daniel X Family Office?
Yeah, this one was weird. Daniel X Family Office is listed as the investor.
Family Office.
Yes.
Participating.
Not his personal or his professional, his family office.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what? Okay. Okay, Derry.
Yeah.
Derry, okay. Homa is the second French mobile studio to make a major move recently because, you know, we talked about Voodoo's Beach Bum acquisition just, you know, a handful of minutes ago with our pocket sand. Homa is focused on hyper-casual and board games and boasts 500 million installs. The publisher solicits Unity prototypes and tests them for market viability for further funding.
Yeah, it's an interesting model. So you as a developer can make a prototype in Unity, send it off to Homa. They're like, yeah, this has some potential. We could do this. And then they give you money to finish out the game, and then they publish it.
Interesting.
Yeah, right?
That's very interesting.
All right, what else we got? Last investment interlude story for the day. SideQuest VR, which exists to sideload content onto devices like the Oculus Quest, has raised $3 million.
Oh, there we go.
I've actually used SideQuest VR
on... I'm pretty sure James has, too.
Yeah, I think I used James' guidance on... installing it on the the round was led by
have a software engineer in the house.
The round was led by Pro Founders with Ada Ventures, Connect Ventures, SCNE, and others participating. Funds are going to be used to support SideQuest development efforts and to support its efforts with discovery and community for the next generation of VR devs. Because that's the other thing, SideQuest has on their website is like it helps surface some stuff that isn't available natively on the Oculus Store, for instance.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. That's fantastic. That wraps up Investment Interlude. We are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with something.
Cool.
Virtual Economy is an F-Squared initiative, and along with pro bono business consulting for up-and-coming developers, it's a way we are working to give back to the community that has already given us so much. To find out more about F-Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz.
And we are back. Hey, Mike, what time is it?
It's time for Quick Hits.
I did jazz hands with one hand.
With one hand. What's the sound of one jazz hand clapping? Flap, 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 flap.
I'm flapping my hand right by the microphone. It's not working. No one can hear it. Okay, anyway. So what do we got first?
You know, the first one's all you.
The first one's all me. I love it. Starting off with some successes. PotionCraft has sold more than 100,000 copies in its first 3 days on Steam. Let me tell you a story about PotionCraft. It's excellent.
Yeah, you played the demo, and then you played the final release.
I did
when it came out. So
that's awesome. I loved it. Yeah. I think I got a code for it accidentally forgot that I got a code for it, and so I bought it anyway because I'm like, no, I need to support the developers. I love them.
Well, I'm sure you can find a home for that code.
I would imagine so. Well, maybe we'll have to do a giveaway for it.
Yeah. Next up, Netflix has. We talked about Netflix earlier, but some additional Netflix news. They've soft launched 3 more games: Shootin' Hoops, Teeter Up, and Card Blast, into its service for subscribers that with Android devices in Poland, Spain, and Italy, where it soft launched this service.
Absolutely. So we're keeping an eye on it to see how things end up rolling out to the rest of the world. I would anticipate that Canada and New Zealand and Australia will probably be the next territories they'll want to roll out to next. All right, Capcom has announced some shipment milestones. Mike, I can't talk about Capcom. These are all you, man.
All right.
This is all you.
So Monster Hunter Rise has shipped 7.5 million copies since its March 2021 launch. That's the good news. The bad news is I think they're shooting themselves a little bit in the foot here. They have announced that they have heard the calls for cross-play and cross-prog.
Even if they only did cross progression and not cross play, that would have been okay.
Yeah.
But no cross progression means that it's a non-starter.
Part of the problem is they don't have a unified. I mean, they have the Resident Evil network thing where you can sign in, but they don't have a network system. Like if you think about EA, right, where you sign into EA services, Ubisoft, Ubisoft services.
Yes.
Capcom doesn't have anything like that. So they would need to implement something, an account-based system, in order to take your Switch progress for Monster Hunter Rise. And bring it over to the PC version.
Yes.
Now, the PC version is going to boast all of the things you would expect a PC version to have. Better frame rates, better resolutions, all of that stuff.
Of course.
It is a bummer. I did see this coming. You can't use Amiibo on the PC version, so at least I'll, like, sleep well at night knowing that I have my Amiibo and all of the tappity-taps that I've done.
All your tappity-taps.
Yep. Also, Resident Evil 3 has shipped 4.4 million copies since its April 2020 release. We knew that one wasn't as powerful. Again, it was a remake.
Yeah.
So, a good remake. Not as good as Resident Evil 2, but...
I think it's also not as beloved as Resident Evil 2.
I think you're absolutely right. I think 3, just in general, like, people really, really love 2. And 4. 2 and 4 are beloved. 3, a little bit less.
Sure.
And last up, Resident Evil 7 has moved more than 10 million units since its January 2017 release. Ooh. So Capcom continuing to really make the best of its IP and making some very smart decisions. They have been for the last 5 years.
Absolutely. That's great for them.
Yeah.
Speaking of great things.
Yeah.
Humble Bundle has announced that it has raised $200 million for charity since its launch in 2013.
I know, yeah, and I know that we talked about how they've changed the sliders and people aren't thrilled. The reality of the situation is if we want Humble to continue existing and being able to be a funnel for charities, then they need to have enough money to survive. And this is
for overhead.
Yeah.
And you have extensive experience working for nonprofits. I work for a nonprofit right now, yeah, too.
I mean, what I can say is that the hardest money to raise is your general expense. Your unrestricted donations.
Yeah.
And being able to raise money to do the work that you do is actually easier. Being mm-hmm. able to raise the money to execute on your programs is easier. But to raise the money for the structures around that is very, very difficult. So I understand why they made the changes to the sliders. I think they were clumsy in the way they initially rolled them out. I do like the way they have stepped back, readdressed them, and then re-implemented them.
Sure.
Eidos Montreal has announced that it is switching permanently to a 32-hour, 4-day work week. You absolutely love to see it.
Results-only work environments work!
Yep, and I think that as we start seeing more studios come forward that are establishing themselves as healthy work environment studios, the pressure is put on existing veteran studios, as it were, like Eidos Montreal.
To continue to lead by example.
Exactly.
It's so important. And quite frankly, it's an important next step for tech in general, mm-hmm. not just for gaming, but for tech, for entertainment. These tend to be industries that crunch their people, and it's all about butts and seats mm-hmm. instead of it being about taking care of the people that matter. So, you know. Love to see it.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. All right. Microids has announced the opening of a new studio in Paris. The studio will be led by Antoine Villette, who worked on The Alone in the Dark, The New Nightmare. Ooh, I actually really liked The New Nightmare.
Mm.
And Cold Fear.
Mm. This just hit today.
It did, yeah.
Jeff Strain, founder of Undead Labs and co-founder of ArenaNet, has announced a new studio called Possibility Space. Again, we talk about studios that are founded around the idea of healthy work environments, right?
Mm-hmm.
This one is another. And this team, by the way, is absolutely stacked. Just going to read down the list of people who were named in the press release. Jane Ng, who did art on Firewatch for Camposanto,
oh my gosh,
and who also worked on Half-Life Alyx.
Yep.
She is the visual director at Possibility Space. Austin Walker, who we've been wondering after he left Waypoint or Vice Games or whatever they changed
whatever.
Name to. He was the EIC,
yep.
the founding EIC at Waypoint.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
And he is now the IP director at Possibility Space.
Love that.
Liz England, who worked, who was the, I think, the lead designer on Watch Dogs Legion, but also worked on, and you're going to freaking love this, Sunset Overdrive.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm familiar with Liz England's work.
Yeah. She is in charge of simulation. She's the simulation and narrative systems director.
Cool.
Richard Fogue, who was at Undead Labs and probably Monsters, is the design director. Brandon Dillon, who was at Oculus and Double Fine, is the VP of engineering. Leah Rivera, who was at Undead Labs and ArenaNet, senior narrative systems designer. Brian Jennings was at NZXR and Magic Leap, is the technical design director. And then Charles Randall, who was at Ubisoft and BioWare, and Erica Tam, who was at EA and Oculus, are both senior gameplay engineers. A lot of XR in there. A
lot of XR in there.
So, very interested to see what they're working on. Probability Space is a physically distributed studio. It does have a physical headquarters in New Orleans, but it is, for all other intents and purposes, remote enabled, I guess.
I like that.
So, I guess that's what we're calling those hybrid environments where you have a physical location, but you are allowing people to work elsewhere.
Yeah. I really like that. That sounds great. I'm very excited to see what they're going to be working on, because that's an incredible team.
It is an amazing team.
All right.
It's also, you know, it's a diverse team.
It is. Yeah. Yes. Because how many times have we had new studio announcements, and we're like, y'all.
Creative white dudes.
Y'all, can we have more diversity? And you know what? It's really important to note that because this is a, quote, physically distributed studio, they're able to hire diverse candidates because they don't require them to move.
Yes.
Because moving is prohibitively expensive, especially moving to a city. And I don't know anything about the cost of living in New Orleans. I've only visited the city once, but I don't know. This is the way.
Yeah.
This is the way. Okay. Tencent's Honor of Kings has crossed the $10 billion. What? $10 billion in lifetime revenue. That's incredible. According to Sensor Tower. I'm sorry. It took me a second. I'm like, is that 10?
That's 10.
That's 10. Okay. We're going for it. It launched in 2015 and is the first mobile game to reach that milestone. It has even surpassed the beauty of Pokemon's Go.
Well, there you go.
Microsoft is also introducing a host of accessibility features for Xbox, including a bunch of new store tags and the ability to filter colors. 20 accessibility tags will be supported, including narrated game menus, input remapping, and single stick gameplay. Developers will need to hit a set of standards in order to utilize those tags, which will enforce a consistent quality standard.
I do love that.
Yep, it's really important. It's important to note that these tags have not rolled out yet to everyone. They're going to be rolling out over the coming months, but they have rolled out to the Xbox Accessibility Insiders League, and they will be providing feedback. So those tags, those 20 tags as they exist today, may not exist in the same capacity in the coming months as the Accessibility Insiders League sits down, talks with them, and says, hey, this works, hey, this doesn't, hey, did you consider, you know, adding additional tags, things like that. Microsoft is rolling out a system-wide night mode feature.
Oh, neat.
Quick settings, which will make it easier to toggle accessibility features, and renaming the, quote, ease of use section to accessibility for, well, ease of use.
Interesting. I do want to highlight, I know that talking about Ubisoft is really challenging because of all of the cultural issues that have been there. I booted up. We got codes for Far Cry 6.
We did, yes.
Our schedule has not allowed us to stream it. And the next time I do stream, I'm going to open this up because I want to walk through this. And Can I Play That had an amazing breakdown of the accessibility features. And if you're not aware of Can I Play That, please become aware of Can I Play That.
And the incredible team that they have there, led by the amazing Courtney Craven.
Indeed. And it's not just for people who are looking for information about the accessibility settings in the game. I have learned so much for the work that we do, and we're by no means accessibility experts.
Oh gosh, no. Not
but
even
it
a little.
Has helped us understand the questions to ask and the things to look for when we are working with our clients.
And be able to push people in a direction to go and chat with an actual accessibility consultant who will be able to help them to better refine what those menus need to look like for different kinds of disabilities.
Yeah. And one of the things I loved about the Far Cry 6 accessibility stuff, and again, I will display this when I show it on screen. In fact, I want to focus on this, is they have those quick settings up front. And it says like, hey, if you toggle this on, it will adjust a number of settings. So there's visual ones and auditory ones. The cognitive load settings are really, really interesting.
Yeah, it's super cool. Remember, Xbox and Microsoft have been at the forefront of gaming for everyone. That is the way that they conduct themselves as a team. That is now spreading out to the industry because we needed an industry leader to step up and say, no, this is important. We have to make games accessible. And we will continue to see that trickle out, especially into their wholly owned first-party studios. Mm-hmm. I am really, really, really looking forward to seeing what Microsoft does with their wholly owned studios, including Bethesda.
Absolutely.
Because as we have understood, Deathloop was not even remotely an accessible game for anyone with disabilities. And it was very, very heartbreaking to watch some of our fave people, you know, in the content creation space, be like, I can't play this game.
Yeah.
And I'm really bummed. And somebody should have called an accessibility consultant at the very beginning of this project.
Absolutely.
Microsoft, I would imagine, will be enforcing the gaming for everyone ethos, even on Bethesda.
Absolutely. And again, just cycling back to Ubisoft, you and I noticed this at the beginning of this console generation. We got we got codes for Valhalla. Mm-hmm. We got codes for
Legion.
Legion was another one. Mm-hmm. And then also Immortals Fenyx Rising.
Yes.
The way that Ubisoft has started defaulting to presenting its accessibility settings at the front with narrated menus so that, yes, if you require that, you can actually find the settings you need because the menus are narrated right up front.
It's really great. And again, we needed Microsoft to lead the way. We needed somebody to lead the way on that. And yes, Ubisoft has an exceptional team, an accessibility team that has been, that comes from all over the industry, including including Twitch as well for their accessibility team. And it grows and it's grown and grown. And the amount of work that that accessibility team has put in has just been truly exceptional.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, credit where credit's due. Ubisoft has a lot of cultural problems, but remember, there are people inside these companies who are working hard to make sure that the cultures get fixed and that that their games are playable by a wide range of people.
Gaming is for everyone.
Absolutely. All right, here's a weird one.
Oh, gosh, this story.
So Bloomberg reported out that more than 10 developers had 4K dev kits for a new version of the Nintendo Switch.
Right.
That they were, the headline was something along the lines of, we're making 4K games for a system that doesn't exist, or something like that.
Oh, okay.
The interesting thing is this story hit in the days leading up to last Friday's launch of the Switch OLED edition.
Swoled.
The Swoled. Yes. Among the developers that supposedly had one of these magic 4K test kits was Zynga, which is working on a free-to-play Star Wars game called Star Wars Hunters.
I'm very interested in Star Wars Hunters.
Yeah.
Because I honestly and genuinely really like Zynga's games.
So Nintendo's investor relations Twitter account shot down the report entirely, saying, quote, a news report on September 30th, 2021 falsely claims that Nintendo is supplying tools to drive game development for a Nintendo Switch with 4K support. To ensure correct understanding among our investors and customers, we want to clarify that this report is not true. Now, this is some very interesting language. Now, let's talk about what would happen if a United States-based IR company account or their official IR representative made that kind of statement like that. You have to be super careful because you cannot, like, PR, you can fudge more easily. In the United States, IR, there's no fudging there because you can, if you are accused of misleading investors,
you can be subject to shareholder lawsuits.
Exactly.
As we have seen.
Now, I want to identify the language here.
Mm-hmm.
They said, development for a Nintendo Switch with 4K report. And that's not true. But what if it's not? What if there are dev kits out there for a 4K system that isn't for the Nintendo Switch? We know that, look, at any point in a console...
That's a lot of speculation, my heart.
It is a lot of speculation, but again, I'm thinking about how IR works, and it's like, okay, but you could legitimately say, it wasn't technically for a Nintendo Switch, we didn't lie.
But I think the important point is Zynga coming back on this. And
this was weird, right?
This is really strange. So talk us through this.
So Zynga has then distanced itself from being a named company in the Bloomberg story. Now, it wasn't a Zynga, like an official Zynga representative who said to Bloomberg, yeah, totally, we got one of these kits. It was somebody from within the company.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have the company itself saying, nuh-uh, we don't. That whomever your source was outright lied to you and said, told Kotaku, quote, Zynga does not have a 4K developer kit from Nintendo. So that's not even Nintendo Switch. That's no. Like, we don't have any 4K development kits from Nintendo. And none of the developer kits Zynga has or is in receipt of are 4K developer kits.
Mm-hmm.
So that puts that casts a wider net in terms of the denial. Whereas Nintendo said there was no Nintendo Switch with 4K support kit. Zynga's like, there is no such thing, period, from Nintendo.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a weird situation.
It's a very strange situation, but, you know, what can you do?
Yep.
Except distance yourself from it and disavow all knowledge.
Yeah. So why don't you take the next story? Because there's actually, Greg just popped into our Discord an update to the story we're about to cover.
Oh, okay. So you want to go and grab that?
I'm going to go grab it. Because Dan Ahmad tweeted about it.
Okay, sounds good. So EA is signaling that it is moving away from FIFA branding on its massively popular soccer series. What?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about brand value and why that is such a huge deal.
Yes. Well, okay. brand value, especially for something like FIFA. FIFA is a globally recognized, it's globally recognized. It's a, for, as a football league, right?
Yeah.
Everybody knows what FIFA is.
Yes.
It might be corrupt as hell, but everybody knows what it is.
Right. And the fact that EA's, I think this is their best selling game worldwide.
It is, as far as I'm under, as far as I understand, on a regular basis, this is their best selling game.
And it is probably, I think, and again, I think this is pretty safe to say, it is the game of EA's that generates the most in-app transactions through Ultimate Team packs.
Yep.
And that's where Ultimate Team started. Started with FIFA and then spread to Madden and Shell.
Yep.
So, all right. So here's the thing. You spend years and years and years. I mean, FIFA's been around for what?
Ever.
20, 30 years at this point?
More than that. Oh, are you talking about the soccer game?
I'm talking about the game. EA's FIFA.
Yes. EA's FIFA has been around since, like, I think 1996, 1997.
Oh, I'm looking it up.
While he's doing that, EA Sports General Manager Cam Weber shared the news that the publisher is looking to rename the franchise and is reviewing its naming rights deal with FIFA. The company has filed with the UK Intellectual Property Office and EU Intellectual PR?
Who knows?
Oh, Property Office.
Oh, God.
All right, well, that's...
Folks, our show notes are sometimes a train wreck.
Well, that was a fun thing for me to figure out. EA Intellectual Property Office.
The Property Office. It's Catwoman.
To register the name EA Sports FC.
The FC being football club, of course.
I get it.
That's not a bad name.
No, it is not a bad name. No filing in the U.S. yet. So, Mike, what did you learn about FIFA the game?
Okay, 1993 was the first game, by the way.
Oh, wow.
So we are heading up on the 30-year anniversary.
Oh, no.
Crumble.
Oh, the 30-year anniversary.
In my defense, I was but a mere babby.
Yes, you were.
In 1993, I was 7.
Okay, so there have been some developments. The first is that EA extended its contract with FIFPro, which is the Players Association.
Okay.
So it will continue to include names and likenesses. Now, that's a big thing. If you remember from Konami's Pro Evolution Soccer, which is now eSports Football or something like that. And it's apparently terrible.
I liked PES.
Yeah, PES.
PES was better.
So that was a big deal, is they didn't have licenses to the teams, to a lot of the teams and players. So it's a big selling point for EA that they still have that. Now, that is not the same as its deal with FIFA.
Okay.
Which would give them the right to use the name. And remember, because every 4 years, the FIFA game is the FIFA World Cup game?
Yes.
All right. So, New York Times and Dan Ahmad from Nico Partner shared this, and Greg Alderton in our Discord
popped it in some time.
So, Greg, your timing, freaking awesome, bud.
Yeah.
So, here's the deal. According to the New York Times, the reason why there's friction is FIFA wants to double what it's charging EA for licensing, $1 billion or more every 4 years for the license.
You know what?
And limit EA's ability to monetize beyond the game itself. So cut them off at the knees. And I wonder if that has anything to do with Ultimate Team. Yeah. So with that, here's the quote that Dan shared from the New York Times. At least 2 years of talks about renewing the contract that allows Electronic Arts through its EA Sports division to use the organization's name have hit the wall, according to multiple people close to the negotiations. Possibility of a permanent break after next year's World Cup in Qatar, when the current 10-year agreement ends, was made explicit in a letter released last week by Cam Weber, the executive president and general manager of EA Sports. Now, EA Sports, Cam Weber,
yes,
did put out this blog. It's like, hey, we're thinking about changing the name. I actually like EA Sports FC. I think that's a really smart name for the game. And this is the big question.
I don't think it's compelling, but it is descriptive.
But now, they could just release it as EA Ultimate Team Football or something like that.
Sure. Again, very descriptive.
Yes.
Not a great name.
Right. And here's the thing.
You need things like that to be, like, sticky, right? And interesting, to stick in your brain. EA Sports FC will not stick in my brain. In fact, it's already falling out of it from the other ear like sand.
I mean, they could also just turn it into EA Football Club or something like that.
I mean, EA Football Club certainly has broader appeal from my perspective, at any rate. Anyway, so Continue.
So the interesting thing here is, and this is the calculus, right? EA has to look at this and say, all right, you're limiting our revenue potential. You're charging us potentially twice as much. So we're looking at $250 million a year or more to just have the license. Is the brand, the FIFA, EA Sports FIFA, valuable enough as a brand to offset these additional costs and the reduced revenue? Or are we better off just saying, you know what? This is a really opportune time for us to make a big change. Drop the FIFA name, make shifts to Ultimate Team such that they are scaling back Loop. And then you have this big shift. The re-education that needs to happen because you have players. And this is the thing. We talk about core players a lot.
Rebranding is so hard. It's so hard.
The spend on that to make sure that people know that when they walk into GameStop or Best Buy or Target or Walmart or wherever it is they purchase their game, wherever they purchase their video games, or know what to look for on the online stores.
Sure.
That it's like, oh, there is no more FIFA. It's the same game. It's the same, you know, annual iteration, but we've changed the name. So here's the thing. I wonder if they rebrand now. Because next year is the last year.
Right.
Rebrand it next year and then they can put on the front, formerly EA Sports FIFA, and have a year of transition.
Sure. And like that's all fine. I think that the thing to understand about this is that the spend on this isn't just about the marketing. It's also going to be about the user acquisition and user retention. User retention is going to be exceptionally expensive if they're not careful.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And where, from my perspective, if I'm looking at this either as a player or even as an investor, this would make me nervous as an investor because this is brand recognition that is going to go away.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest sticking point here is if you've got a partner, a licensing partner who's turning the screws on you and you've been using that licensing partner's name as your brand. First of all, you've made a tactical error 30 years ago at this point.
Well, we can't actually hop back in a time machine, so there's nothing to be done about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure at the time they're like, we can call our game FIFA. That's going to have instant brand recognition. And then 30 later, oh no. This is 30 years of, effing around, and then finding out 30 years later, oh, maybe we should have built our own brand.
I hate that for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I do feel for them, and I do understand the challenge here. And I'm glad they've been handling it as well as they could. They put out that warning, like, "Hey, we're thinking about changing the name." And of course, all of us who know are looking at this, going, "Something's going on." There is some tension. Yeah, exactly. All right, what else we got?
All right, on the people can fly doing some cool stuff.
Yes.
They are moving into AA game experiences alongside their AAA shooters.
Mm-hmm.
So the AA games would have quality comparable to previous titles, but would be, quote, characterized by a shorter development time, lower budget, and smaller scope.
I mean, you're singing my song at this point. Give me shorter games.
Well, yes. I mean, shorter development time doesn't necessarily mean shorter games.
Okay.
But
also give me shorter games.
Well, that's a whole other conversation. They're looking to expand their teams and potentially do some more in the way of acquisitions. They already have 7 studios globally, wow, including their most recent acquisition of Phosphor Studios in April.
All right.
So, yeah, people can fly, moving into AA. Listen, we are at an incredible lack of AA games of high quality.
Mm-hmm.
It is, I think that when I think about games that I really, really love, I usually love the games that hit that sweet spot in between indie and AA. Like the top end of what is considered like a truly indie budget and then moving into those AA quality games that are still published by like independent developers. Those tend to be my sweet spot of games that I love. So I like this.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
Yeah. All right. We have some staff shuffling stories.
There's some weird stuff going on.
Slide them right back to EA.
Right on back to EA.
Yep. They have announced that longtime CFO Blake Jorgensen is leaving the company after more than a decade. His departure is planned for summer of 2022. Laura Milley, who is the head of EA Studios, is going to be stepping into the COO role, which was also held by Jorgensen. That's a lot.
Chris Bruzzo is getting promoted from chief marketing officer to chief experience officer, and he will be, quote, leading EA's efforts to build social ecosystems that forge stronger connections and create amazing player experiences in and around our games. In other words, the thing we keep talking about over and over again.
Engagement.
There was also, I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing yet, from, I believe it was last Friday, an interview with Eurogamer where they really pushed Bruzzo about things like Ultimate Team loot boxes.
That's really good. Good for them.
Yeah. So I haven't had a chance to read that yet, but I am very interested.
Love to see people asking the hard questions. All right. Over at Gearbox, Embracer Group owned Gearbox has reorganized itself. There is a new parent entity called Gearbox Entertainment Company, under which there are three pillars. Randy Pitchford will lead Gearbox Entertainment and is moving away from his leadership of the game development side of things. He'll be leading the new Gearbox Studios, which is the transmedia pillar.
I guess he liked having a trailer on the set of the Borderlands movie.
Yeah, okay, fine, yeah. Whatever. Steve Jones, former CTO, is now leading Gearbox Software. Steve Gibson continues to lead Gearbox Publishing.
So someone asked me on Twitter, it's like, I don't understand, like, why this is the way it is, because Embracer owns them. Isn't that the parent company? It's yes, but you have these very large companies. And you have to organize your projects and your staffing in order to keep them
resources.
Focused.
Yeah. Honestly, it's not even just focus. It comes down to resource management and ensuring that when you're looking at budgeting, both in terms of budgeting your people's time and budgeting your money, you know, having these silos, these pillars in which these projects exist, it's super, super important to keep them, you know, away from each other. Right?
Yeah,
keep them siloed.
It is. And that way you have some definition. I think having organizational structure is important. There can be too much. You know, that's where you get into middle managers and stuff. But I think that this enables people to understand, like, what is happening in each of these companies. And for reporting up, because you're not just reporting, you're not just managing down, you're also reporting up to something like Embracer. This is a smart way to organize.
And I'm sure that it makes Embracer's involvement a little less clunky.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at also, like, Embracer owns Koch Media.
Yeah, sure.
And they're organized into, they have their game publishing, they've got Deep Silver, right? And they have their distribution. So you have, like, this isn't uncommon. And the example that I gave, although I'm loath to talk about them right now, the easiest one to explain is Activision, which has Activision Publishing and King and Blizzard and MLG. Sure. And then you have structures underneath all of those pillars.
Right. And yeah, listen, corporate structures are weird, and it is important to report on those changes to better understand those underpinnings.
Absolutely.
For no other reason than understanding.
Yes, exactly. All right, we're wrapping up the day with three epic stories. First up, Apple has requested a stay on the injunction that was levied against it following the lengthy court battle with Epic Games. If you might recall that the injunction requires Apple to allow developers to promote alternative pricing and payment options inside the App Store apps, even if it does not allow alternative payment processing within those apps. Apple pretty much won that case with the exception of this injunction.
Yeah.
And it has now shut Epic out of its ecosystem pending a final verdict that is unappealable, and that could take years.
It could take literal years to get there.
Additionally, Google, having sat back and waited to see what happened with the suit against Apple, has now filed a countersuit against Epic using pretty much the same arguments that allowed Apple to win. And Google's already in a better position because it is not a fully closed ecosystem.
Yes.
So I don't see Epic doing terribly well in the Google suit.
Okay.
Google was very tactical here. Not that I have any love for Google, by the way.
Yeah. No, I do remember when I had love for Google. Back when on their website, on their about page, it said, do no evil.
Do no evil. Well,
I remember that. Now it is only do no weevils.
Wow. There's a section of the internet for that, but you need to be 18, over 18. And
well, this got sufficiently weird.
Yep. What's next?
In good news for worried parents and concerned developers in kiddo-friendly spaces, Epic Games and Super Awesome are offering free parent verification for all developers. Starting on September 30th, Epic made the Kids Web Services parent verification free for all developers globally via Epic Online Services. Now, for those that are not familiar with KWS, it enables developers to verify the identity of parents or guardians when granting their children permission to use features that collect personal information. So this is absolutely making sure that children's personal information is being protected and that adheres to the current COPPA laws in the United States specifically. So, quote, once a parent is verified using KWS and is part of the super awesome network of verified parents and guardians called the Parent Graph, they never need to provide their verification details again for any other service that uses KWS technology.
Very interesting.
So they don't have to double submit all of, or submit their information in duplicate or triplicate or whatever, depending on how many apps are using KWS, to ensure that children's data is being protected and that parent identities are also being protected. This is a wonderful, wonderful thing, making this essentially, making this free to include in, if you use Epic Online Services. It's just, I love this. I really, really do. I love developers taking child safety more seriously. It is ultimately up to the parents to keep children safe, to keep their children safe when it comes to being on the internet, playing online games, playing mobile games, whatever. But knowing that developers care makes all the difference.
Absolutely. And last up, Epic acknowledging finally that it's the imposters mode for Fortnite was
horrid.
We'll go with inspired by Inner Sloths Among Us. And is now
liberally cribbed, I believe.
Yeah, liberally cribbed. Epic is now working to make that right, clearly. They acknowledged the Among Us influence in a blog post. And then on Twitter, the two brands had an adorable little exchange. And it seems like they will be working together on something. We shall see what that is.
That's necessary.
It is. It's the right thing to do. Step. Like this was an error in judgment from Epic.
I think so. I think that Epic thought of itself as untouchable in this particular regard. It's just like, oh, who cares? It's Fortnite. And who cares? It's Among Us. They're a tiny little company. No one cares about them.
Epic was well within its rights.
Of course. Ethically, not even a little bit. Mm-mm. Not even a little bit. This isn't even like it's an Epic or an ethical gray area. It's just, no, this was ethically wrong.
Yeah, and enough people spoke out about it that it became unavoidable.
It knows we certainly
did. Yeah, it made it unavoidable. So look, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to make bad decisions. How you fix them is what's important. And it was really good to see Epic do this. So
absolutely.
Delighted to see that. And that, well, we're done.
Wait, hold on.
And that's the end of the show.
That was great. I want to do that more often.
So thank you for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
And I am at Amanda Farrow. You can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconcast.com. We are also available on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Amazon, Stitcher, Pocket Cast. I always forget this last one.
Pocket Sand!
Did you miss saying that?
Pocket sand.
You know, and I said I wish you sang to me more often. This is not
pocket
really
sand. Oh yeah.
He had to reach for that one, but okay. If you enjoyed getting caught up on all of the industry news, including Investment Interlude and our quick hits, we'd love it if you would subscribe, and if possible, on your platform of choice, review the show. We'd love to know what you think. We love tiny little love letters in the form of reviews.
Yep. You can also DM us with questions, or you can send them to podcast@fsquared.biz. Mm-hmm. You can ping us on the Twitters.
Yep.
You can hit us up in our Discord. If you want an invite to our Discord, just hit one of us up or hit up the Virtual Econcast Twitter account. We'd be glad to invite you in. We also, so the Discord, did I mention that? We have a coffee. ko-fi.
We keep talking about
.com/virtual.
We keep talking about it.
Economy. Is it virtual economy or virtual econcast?
No, it's virtual economy.
Virtual economy.
We keep talking about this, and I know that it exists, and I have it on my to-do
list.
Folks,
our lives have been a chaotic thunderstorm
since I believe the middle of July.
Yeah, it's been a banana pants time, folks. We are eventually also going to be live streaming this show. We are waiting on just one more thing. and then we can, and also some time, and then we can do this. Hopefully,
we have to build our bar table.
Yeah, hopefully, like next week or the week after. Not episode 105, sadly. It's not going to be this Saturday.
It's not going to be this Saturday. We tried, man. We tried. We are
trying so hard. Marching band. Hell of a drug. But yeah, we'll be back next week. And in the meantime, remember to... Or actually, we're going to be back on Saturday.
We're going to be back on Saturday.
For an actual regular show at the regular time.
Are we going to have all of our regular segments?
There will probably be a couple of investment things and maybe some quick hits. But it's largely going to be the main story. So we've kind of broke up this beast into two halves.
I'm here for it.
It's the beast with two...
Nope. Nope. Extremely nope. And with that, we will be back on Saturday. So remember to wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another and pay exactly zero attention to Mike's shenanigans. We'll see you soon.